So, The Myth of the Great Ending is a new book by Dr. Joseph Felser. He has a great pedigree, graduated from Boston University and then on to the University of Chicago, where he got his doctorate. And he writes a book that I wish I had lived long enough to have written myself. It was actually sort of a relief to see somebody address the problem of time. And a subject that comes up all the time on Coast to Coast is, are we living in a linear existence or a cyclical one? That is to say, are we looking at the end of time in our lifetime? Will we see the lights go out, like hitting off on a TV screen? Will just be one little white dot come May 21 of 2011, and then the screen goes black, and that's it, we're done? Or will that happen in December of 2012? Or is it going to be more like how other people have said that with every ending, there's a great beginning? And so it is that he asks the question, why we've been longing for the end of days since the beginning of time. Why is that? He answers that with this: the world has ended, is ending, and never will end. And we'll explain that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Joseph Felser is a professor at Kingsborough Community College in New York City and the author of The Myth of the Great Ending. Good evening, Dr. Felser.
Good evening, Ian. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. I love what you've written here. I've been making similar arguments, but not nearly as well researched and articulated for years. So I really mean it. You've done a great job with this because I think there is an obsession, and I would even probably offer a few more suggestions on why, but on the fact that so many people seem to be rooting for the world to end. Seemingly just to say, I told you so. I mean, or in the time that they have to say, to yell, I told you so, just before the lights go out.
Well, when you look at it in a linear way, I think there's a kind of intellectual and emotional satisfaction about saying, well, this is the ending. If you have a beginning and you have a beginning, middle, and ending, like Aristotle says, and if you know you've gone through the beginning and you think you're in the middle and you're expecting the ending, then, if you can pin it down, there is some pleasure in that. So I think, yeah, but it's a kind of
Well,
perverse pleasure. It's a kind of pleasure that you
yeah.
get from, stopping by the accident on the highway kind of thing. And that turns us into spectators, and I think that's part of the problem.
Well, and we'll talk more about how we should be looking at time, but I do think that there's an element to some people just not wanting the party to go on after they're done. They want all the tables and the chairs to be returned, and no more chips out. When they're done with the party, they want the party done.
I think that's true. I see. I guess I follow Joe Campbell in this, in the sense that he thinks that around 500 years BCE, something fundamentally shifted in our attitude toward life. He thinks this happened in the East and in the West. And he calls it, in his thinking, the term he uses is the Great Reversal. And this has to do with the patterns of time, and also with certain developments that occurred in history having to do with results of warfare and so forth, and that we basically went from a kind of acceptance to a kind of rejection of
Okay.
life in the world.
Well, before we talk about what we reject, we'll have to be more specific about what we're reversing. So let's get down to cases then. It hasn't always been the case that every culture thought that the world would come to a dramatic end. But there are versions of what an ending would be like
Yes.
that we can see. And let's start with the Mayan prophecy, as this is top of mind for a lot of people as we're counting down to 2012. So let's address that, the Mayan concept of time, that calendar in particular, and what you think they were talking about, and what you think we should be expecting.
Well, I don't think that everyone knows what they were talking about. I think that's part of the problem. Campbell And I'm just following Campbell here.
This is Joseph Campbell, the famous...
Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist. In his book, The Mythic Image, and in other places, what he does is to trace the whole calendric system historically to ancient Babylonia, and a diffusion from there to India, to China, and actually from China to Mesoamerica. And one of the things that he shows and discusses there is the fact that in some of the figures in the Mayan calendar, and I can't be precise about this, I don't have the thing in front of me, but in some of those figures, that there are certain errors that the Chinese made with regard to predictions of eclipses, lunar and solar eclipses, that are basically translated into the Mayan system. So these systems, the whole calendric system is coming from a long time ago in the galaxy far, far away.
Right.
As I say, and the thing is that why did these systems develop to begin with? In my view, I don't think Campbell says this explicitly, but in my view, I think they're part of the problem and not the solution. That's to say that these systems develop out of the anxiety of the rulers and the priestly classes of these rather elaborate civilizations, because they already felt a kind of distance from the cycles of nature. And what they wanted to do was to try and coordinate the mesocosm of society with the macrocosm of the universe. And that's why it became an intellectual project to try and figure out these dates and coordinate the observations, because if something unexpected happened, that was rather ominous, you see, and it meant that maybe the king wasn't in control. And so astrology and astronomy really developed in tandem, because there was always a meaning, a significance to these celestial events.
Well, I want to stop you there for just, because I want to unpack. I know that the tendency, especially for somebody who studies this as much as you do, I do want to be careful about using esoteric language, because there's a lot of people that just we're not even there yet in terms of understanding the complexity of what you just said. Although I get it. In fact, let's go back to the idea that the Chinese, it's contended, influence the Mayans.
Yeah.
And that's just, you're even right there. It's a concept that a lot of people have just never thought that perhaps what we see in the Mayan calendar are errors from a Chinese calendar that was written or originally conceived maybe even hundreds of years before the Mayans.
Right. And the Mayan calendar is late. I mean, the date that they give for the beginning of it at 3113, of course, 13 is a big number there, is thousands of years before the calendar was actually developed. So, you know, I think you have to look at the impulse behind the development of the calendar, and that these calendars were intellectual constructions meant to put people in touch with rhythms that they no longer directly felt or experienced as they once did. And when you look at, for example, the fact that now, you know, that the Hindus, the Indians, had the calendar system too, and they have their great ages, you know, the yugas and the mahayugas and all of this. And the fourth one, which is the one that we're supposedly in now, the Kali Yuga, the fourth and most degenerate of the four great periods, one of the things that, you know, points towards the end time is the mixture of castes. So they identified certain features of their particular social order as a kind of cosmic necessity, see. Now, in my way of thinking, here's another one. In the book of Daniel, there's a prophecy that says, also, you have the four-age system and implicit there. And in the book of Daniel, it says when the also talks about either races or, it's unclear, races or nations mixing, that's going to be a sign of the end time, you know, racial intermarriage or intermarriage between nations and so forth. So things that to us would look like progress were regarded by them as degeneracy, you see. And
right.
And so when I look at these calendar systems, I'm thinking that, you know, this is you already had developed nation states with armies, with division of labor, social hierarchy, slavery, all of these things, and they're looking to try and sort of figure things out intellectually and map it out. And you know, I mean, I'm not saying anything. I mean, you know, when you listen to the Mayan elders, first of all, there was just some Mayan elders that had come come up from Guatemala not too long ago, and they were very upset about the way that they felt that their spirituality was being exploited and misunderstood. And what they said is, look, this is a, because they're operating also from the cyclical perspective, and they're saying, look, this is a time of transformation. But the thing is that what the transformation that's being called for is a more harmonious relationship with Mother Earth, and to try and reverse some of the things that we've been doing. You know, it's not sit back on the sidelines and you know, let's clear the party kind of time. It's get off your butt and get out there and do something. And the thing that they were most concerned about was Monsanto's introduction of genetically modified corn, because they feel, first of all, that it's not spiritual, because it doesn't have the spirit of their indigenous corn, that it takes out all of the other varieties, that there are health concerns and so forth. So they were up here trying to get support to go against Monsanto, because Monsanto was making inroads, because these poor people can't even afford to buy the seed. And once the once this GMO corn gets in there, evidently it's so, you know, whatever it is, it's so powerful a plant that it basically just sucks up all the available resources and pushes everything out. And then it makes people dependent, of course, on the corporation for their livelihood and so forth. So if these people really thought that the world was going to end in another year and a half or whatever, I don't think that they would be upset about corn. You know,
right.
I mean, it would be pretty stupid.
But and let's emphasize what you're talking about, too, when you talk about the cyclical nature, the two ways we can look at time
is
cyclical or linear. And the idea that somehow the Mayans were seeing it, even if they saw that this fourth age was degenerative, it didn't mean that it would end, but just that it would end into another age.
Exactly.
And they're very clear about that. That it's not a matter of they think that everything's going to, you know, the world's going to stop, you know, revolving, or the sun is going to blow up.
No, absolutely. And that's true in all of these cyclical systems. I mean, let me break it down this way. With the circle, you have the temporal aspect, and that's the never-ending cycle of time going round and round and round and round. And there is no absolute beginning. There is no absolute ending. There's just a continual process of change and transformation and the repeating patterns. And you might say that endings are soft and hard, you know, and with the circle, with the cycle, you get soft endings in the sense that it's not absolute. And if you put your finger on any point of the circle, you could say, well, that's the ending and that's the beginning in a sense. I mean, you know, for example, with us, we start our year in January, you know, 7 days after the winter solstice, but you could easily just start the year. You could say, well, the year starts in a few weeks when spring comes up, you know,
right.
Or you could start the year in October, November with the first harvest. So if you look at it, you know, in terms of the operation of the seasons, if you look at it the way these ancient peoples did in terms of the processes of life, it's really arbitrary to say, you know, this is the beginning, this is the ending. So with a circle, everything is always in transformation. That's the temporal aspect. The spatial aspect of the circle is that everything within the circle is enclosed, is one thing, is part of that unit. And so, you know, the Sioux have that saying, Metakuye Oyasin, in their language, in the Lakota language. Literally, everything's a relative. Everything is related to everything else, including the observer to the observed, by the way. And that's where the modern physics thing comes in, you know.
Right.
Now, and then there's the mystical aspect of the circle, and that has to do with the center of the circle, because that's the center is from which everything comes and back into which it's constantly going. And in a lot of these systems, and in the shaman experience that goes back to Paleolithic times, who knows how far back, you have visions of great endings. And when these shamans come out of these experiences, the way they interpret that typically has to do with a total transformation of their personal life in relation to the tribe. And so that's also part of the problem. You know, when they experience the eternity of that center of the circle, that mystical experience, that's a dimension of this whole thing that we've lost because we're so darned literal about interpreting everything.
Right. And part of this conflict between looking at time as a cycle, as a circle, or looking at time linearly, this also speaks not just to our modern conflicts, but also going back to biblical times, it seems like, and although you make a very interesting argument that maybe even this whole linear concept of time started earlier than I thought it did, but that there was, that we were tied into the seasons because everybody depended on the seasons. You know, you needed the rainy season, you needed the growing season, the harvest season. Everybody lived in that cycle.
Yes.
And the farther we get away from cyclical living, the easier it is to not even think about life as a circle anymore, since none of us depend. We can have a tomato 365 days a year. It wasn't always so.
That's right. That's right. Our experience, it's not only that our idea of nature has changed, but it's that our everyday experience of nature has undergone a radical transformation and is undergoing a radical transformation all the time. And that has to do with the thinking that, you know, we are the masters, we're in control. We want to control and dominate nature to the extent that, for example, you know, you look at some of these people on TV, these actors and so forth, and, you know, Black Elk talks about the fact that life is a circle and it's a movement from childhood back to childhood. You know, we're born bald, toothless, independent, and that's the way we go out. Well, you look at some of these people, and they've had so much plastic surgery that they already look, you know, embalmed and stuffed. And,
right. You're talking about the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Well, I'm talking about.
No, I'm kidding. There are some better examples than others.
Yeah,
and that
exactly.
might actually be the best. That might be the best example on TV today of embalmed people doing a TV show together.
You know, the face is a mask. It's just unnatural. I mean, and there was just an article that came out, I think yesterday I was reading, about over a third of Americans have sleep disorder. Difficulties, and of course, this is tied in with depression, with poor performance on the job, with accidents, and so on and so forth, all kinds of health issues. So you're right. I mean, our very physical bodies are the same bodies that we've had for basically 2.5 million years, and the idea came in at a certain point that we are going to not go with it. We're not going to harmonize with nature. That we are going to separate ourselves off from it. We're going to control it. We're going to dominate it. And, of course, now we're decoding our genes because we think that we can even build ourselves better. You know, from the very beginning,
right.
the aim of science has been to conquer death. And of course, this has to do not only conquering disease, but, you know, that old Frankenstein dream of immortality. And we've, as you say, we've gotten away, even on our daily lives, on a daily basis, we've gotten away from those cycles. And it shows.
Well, the other way of looking at time then is the great arrow of history, that this linear notion that that time started at one point with a kind of like the beginning of a line segment.
Yes.
And that we are somewhere along this great line segment and that there will be an ending to it. And that brings us right back to the myth of the great ending. Why we've been longing for the end of days since the beginning of time. Dr. Joseph Felser will continue this conversation coming up. And I specifically want to get then into this A-B comparison between understanding time as round and understanding time as a line segment. Because it may actually be the difference between understanding one's self and never feeling at peace. Or maybe even to go one step further is under of achieving true happiness through life as a circle and living in a kind of anxiousness where you keep thinking at any minute your time is about to run out. And if either of those two things speak to you, you're going to want to stick around for the myth of the great ending, because I also think there's a lot to be said for our history as a nation when we stop thinking about ourselves as on a line segment. And we'll get to that all coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Well, Dr. Joseph Felser's argument on the myth of the great ending, why it is that seemingly both in this culture but in others around the world, we've become obsessed with how it's all going to end and when is it going to end and why isn't it ending fast enough? By some people's measure, can be boiled down to this. Here's his argument, I think, in Nietzsche, and I think it's very interesting, that the myth of the great ending is the psychological residue of the unresolved trauma left by our creation of a linear civilization, that is, a civilization based on a linear time concept, and our rejection of our natural circular rhythms. That we are in this psychological quandary about the end of times because we've given up on our natural state of living cyclically. And as Dr. Felser points out, everything tries to be round. We try to resist that. We try to dominate it by flattening it out, by making it linear. But when we see, when we compare a seasonal concept of time versus a calendar that we can dominate and we can control and we can mark and we can say this is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end, that gives us control. When we give up trying to control time, we will be happier with time. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So Dr. Joseph Felser, the author of The Myth of the Great Ending, we'll talk about the difference between the circle and the line in a moment. I'm reminded, though, during the break there, somebody was just talking about billboards that are up all over the country of advertising the end of time being May 21st, 2011, or more accurately, the second coming of Christ is coming on that day. This is the opinion of Harold Camping, who's behind all of this. And then there's all sorts of financial backing, obviously, that's gotten involved in promoting this concept, which leads you to another reason on why certain people are involved in talking about end times is there's money in it. There's no money in the circle. There's money in end times because it's a motivator, it would seem. If you put up a billboard that said time will never end, or with every great ending, there's a new beginning, there's no call to action. But if you have a set date, May 21st, 2011, suddenly you're going to get people who are going to be sending you money. They're going to be debating you. They're going to be buying your book. They're going to be doing it. Creates controversy and interest that's marked to a specific time. And I think, too, that we have whenever we look at why it is that some people are obsessed with the end of days, it's because it's profitable. What do you think about that?
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, definitely the technological 24/7 news cycle has amped things up incredibly. And
good point.
I think that, if you're of a certain vintage, let me put it that way, if you're about my age, you remember going back to when I was a kid in grammar school, we had fire drills. But we also had these thing called air raid drills.
Right, duck and cover.
Yeah, duck and cover. And you know, we go in the hallway or under our desks or whatever. And it took me a while to figure out, because I was pretty young then, you know, what we were supposedly protecting ourselves from. You know, it wasn't Fokkers. It was those, you know, planes that were going to be dropping or those missiles coming over that were dropping the atomic bomb. So, you know, if you're of a certain age, you've sort of been living with this this concept, this fear, whatever you want to call it, for a long time. And I've seen it transmute into different forms, and even the last big eruption, you know, in the millennium and the Y2K hysteria, you know, you saw that come and go.
Right.
And then you look throughout history and you see this constant, you know. And of course, it's just amplified. It's just everything today is speeded up. Everything is amplified because of the communications revolution and so forth.
Right. So that 24/7 news cycle, though, let's add something to that. Then you also have a desire by many people to live in interesting times. I mean, missing the whole irony of the curse / blessing, may you live in interesting times.
Yes, yeah.
They want their time to be significant, and they want the time that they lived on the planet to be the most significant time ever. And so there's a lot of people who are looking for signs and wonders constantly because they need to find them, because in a way, the meaning of their life is tied to the fact that they were either the person to find the sign or the wonder, or they were the person that was there when time ended. And that makes them better in a way than every other generation that ever came before it.
I mean, I think there are signs and wonders. That's the thing. But we're missing them because they're right in front of us. And you can't really see when you're afraid. I mean, when you're amped up with that kind of fear, that shuts the mind down, and you really can't see the beauty of life and the real mystical aspect of it or experience it when you're in that condition. And I think that points to something that is not profit motive, but there's another kind of motive here. And if you look, for example, at some of these cult groups going back to the 90s, like the Heaven's Gate thing.
Sure.
You have a situation where now there's always this, you know, we're the ones that are going to be saved. And it's this, you know, in-group, out-group kind of thing. And what this belief does is to bind people together in a situation to give them a sense of purpose. Right. and collective unity in opposition to those people that are persecuting them. And this goes even back to the Bible, to, you know, the Jewish eschatological milieu in which Jesus lived and taught. And if you believe what some of the scholars, how they interpret, for example, the, you know, passages in the New Testament, that Jesus himself believed that the end of the world would come, and it says even in the Bible, within this generation shall not pass. So this, you know, this idea and this expectation is very, very old from a, you know, Western cultural standpoint, but it's also something that can be manipulated by people who want to use this thing to get and maintain power and over other people, I mean, the cult leaders and so forth. And it can also be used to manipulate those people. Now, what I'm talking about here is there is an article I saw recently that suggested that maybe the whole Heaven's Gate cult was being manipulated as a kind of thought experiment. No, well, not a thought experiment, but an actual experiment in what would you call it? PSYOPs, a psychological operations experiment by military or that they wanted to see what would happen. You know, can people be manipulated into doing certain things? This kind of thing. So I think that there's a real danger involved in, you can laugh at it, you can sit back and laugh at it and say it's all a lot of hype, and people are making money off of it. But I think that we have to go back to what you were talking about before, and that is the psychological needs of the people who are responding to the hype and are responding to the directions that are being given to them. And I think that's where we have to go because, you know, signal can be sent but not received, and I think it's the reception of it that's the key.
Well, I'll give you a thought from my experience in seminary on the eschatological background from which the original Christian cult came as it separated out from Judaism and then became a church unto itself, is that in a way Jesus was right. That the world as they knew it was going to last about one more generation.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish people had already been smashed into smithereens once. You know, they've already been enslaved a couple of times, but the diaspora that came, the tearing down of the temple, you know, the enslavement that lasted for so long really did effectively end the world that they knew.
Yes.
And so you could, you know, if we didn't get too technical on end of the world, meaning the planet broke apart, volcanoes exploded, you know, the world stopped revolving and turned into a big ice ball in space. If we just look at it in terms of the, for all intents and purposes, both for Jesus, the speaker, and for those people that were recipients of his word, that time did end within about 40 years of his crucifixion, when once more the temple was sacked and burned and the faith was enslaved by an angry, you know, Roman emperor.
Yes.
And so in a way he was right. just, and so we can't look at it necessarily as that he got that one wrong, but that rather sort of enjoy the time that you have, because you may not have this much autonomy.
Well, and what you say is exactly right, and it brings up this whole question of how we interpret these things that are said, and how we interpret not only myths, which Campbell called public dreams, but dreams and visions as well. And I think that in our tradition, and I think Campbell was right about this, that we tend to favor a literal interpretation of things that are understood in other traditions symbolically and inwardly. In other words, just let's take the end of the world issue here. Now, there are texts, I'm sure you know, that there are so-called Gnostic Gospels that were written around the same time and have a lot of the same language in them as the text that got into the official New Testament. But the emphasis in these Gnostic texts, and Gnostic refers to, you know, gnosis is knowledge. In fact, it's the root of our English word knowledge, but it means a kind of inward personal experiential knowledge, not something that you get from a book, right? So in these Gnostic texts, there's one that Campbell loved to quote, the Gospel according to Thomas. And in that, it says, the kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, but people do not see it. The kingdom will not come by expectation. People will not say, see here, see there. In other words, the end of the world is not a mass historical event, just like you said, where the planet's going to turn into an ice ball. The end of the world is a reference. And what is it a reference to? It's a reference to a psycho-spiritual event that you as an individual must experience in the here and now, and must bring it about through an expansion and transformation of your consciousness. So how we whether we interpret it, the end of the world, as, okay, our culture is falling apart, or do we interpret it as literally that 6 billion years that the sun is going to burn itself out? I mean, there are so many different ways to understand these things, but I think that the key thing is that a lot of this imagery cannot be understood in a literal way.
Well, and I want to get back to that, because I think that so much of what is revelatory in the myth of the great ending, we're talking with Joseph Felser. Let me wrap up a thread that I had left hanging out there before we went to the bottom of the hour break, and that is the difference between circular time, a seasonal understanding of time, and a linear. And the difference, I always thought linear time was kind of invented by the time that people started to have, you know, clocks and watches. But actually, you make the argument that the linear time concept, time as an arrow, you know, progressing forward, that predates, you know, again, the actual formation of the Bible in and of itself.
Yeah. I'm following Campbell here. I'm looking at a date of anywhere between 1800 to 1000 BCE, because that's the date, and of course these are very speculative, for the figure in religious history we call Zoroaster. His real name was Zarathustra, and he was the prophet in Persia who effectively, he created, it's not a monotheism that he created, because he had two deities, Ahura Mazda and Angramanu, the god of light and the god of darkness. And they were co-equal and co-evil, that is to say, they always existed, they existed from the beginning of time. And Ahura Mazda created the world, the god of light, and then the god of darkness kind of stuck his finger in it and contaminated it. And ever since then, it's been a mixture of lightness and darkness. And according to this mythology, according to this view, there's been this cosmic struggle, and human beings were created by Ahura Mazda to take his side in this struggle, and there's going to be a war, and we have to make a choice, and as individuals we make a choice to fight either on the side of light or darkness, and that eventually there's going to be a final ending where there's going to be a victory of light over darkness. So this basic pattern that there's a beginning, middle, and an end of history, a beginning, a middle, and an end of time. You know, in Christianity, of course, it's the creation, the fall, and then this long process of atonement. but it's basically that pattern has been there. I mean, it predates all of technology. It predates, the Bible. I mean, it's been there. It's really the root of both the Jewish, the Christian, and the Islamic understanding, and so it's been there a long time. I mean, it certainly predates our scientific understanding. I mean, the scientific one comes in with the idea of a Big Bang, and then the expansion of the universe, and then at some point I think they don't agree on this either. It's just going to continue to disperse into atoms, or somehow it's going to recoagulate into this, like it was in the beginning, this just mass, whether it's going to come together or just stay apart. But again, you have that sequence of beginning, middle, and ending.
Well, in the case of then, as you argue, the need for some people to have this ending comes as a result of the kind of the psychological wear and tear between our natural cyclical rhythms and this linear concept of time, which has been virtually stamped out a seasonal understanding of how our life should be.
Yes, and here on this continent, it only happened about 500 years ago, or it started happening. I mean, when you said that I said that everything tries to be round, actually, that's a direct quote from Black Elk. He says, "The power of the world always works in circles, and everything tries to be round." Now, those people still had an existing society in the late 1800s before it was finally smashed by us. So we still had, on this continent, we still had people who understood, experienced life according to those circular rhythms. And instead of integrating ourselves with them, we basically just pushed them aside.
Well, I think we still do, though. I think we still, if you look in terms of the Amish, I think the Amish still live in a circle, and I think, I think their rejection of clocks and the understanding of, daylight savings time and all this other stuff that they do, and they live much closer to the earth and to a more natural rhythm.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, there's always it's a very complicated situation, and there's always historical developments never happen absolutely and in a kind of smooth way. So we're a little bit schizophrenic because we still have to pay attention to a certain extent, and like you say, the Amish in particular, these groups will we have those seasonal rhythms, and of course we're still living them to a certain extent.
Right.
We still have to live them, and yet we see them in terms of our historical perspective and our evolutionary perspective and our religious perspective tries to bend that hoop out. Take a hacksaw to a hula hoop and bend it out, and instead of a hoop, you have that line. And, we're constantly trying to break that hoop. And you're right. It does create a kind of tension there because, to a certain extent, like, our bodies are still obeying those rhythms, those patterns, and we're trying always to find a way around that, to defeat it, and that's part of the problem, because every effect has unintended causes. Every time you try and manage and control something else doesn't work right. So
I agree, and I'm just as guilty of that as anybody else.
Oh yeah,
I really am. I totally resonate. I like Charlie Sheen. I don't sleep. I wait. I mean, I'm in that same weird place. But, and I want to get back to your what you argue in The Myth of the Great Ending. I want you to talk more about Black Elk coming up. He's a very pivotal figure in this. And also a thought as a system, thought systems, and how they conflict with our natural rhythms. But some very specific ideas of the great ending, as it's understood by the Thomas Gospel, which Dr. Joseph Felser was just talking about. And then we'll get to your questions and comments, not this hour, but coming up. And so write them down. Don't forget them. The Myth of the Great Ending. Why is it that you want there to be an ending in your lifetime? Coming up on Coast to Coast.